Hi, Nate.
Hey, Tom.
In the world of open source, there's a timeless cone. In the forest of code, a solitary programmer pondered a problem, lost in the labyrinth of their own thoughts. Seeking clarity, they reached out to the wider community. A fellow coder with no obligation but a shared love for creation offered guidance. Together, they danced in the digital ether, exchanging ideas like leaves in the wind. In the end, the problem remained unsolved, yet the programmer found peace in the journey. For in the embrace of open source, enlightenment isn't in the destination, but in the connections forged along the way. This is OpenAI's ChatGPT's manifestation of the spirit of open source.
Yeah, rumor is they're going to change to closed AI because Elon said so. But that's really not the discussion we're going to have. We maybe will wrap up with that. I think it's mostly smoke and mirrors. The order of running. Well, I'm looking at it. I think, Tom, we got to get you on this webcam. You're on like potato quality video right now. But the order of running is Claude 3 in the arms race that the Doomers have created themselves after being so worried about it, and some more on understanding where openness in AI is going to. I get invited to bougie events about openness in AI, and they are interesting. They're not a waste of time. It feels in a way like it's the room where open source AI definitionally will be defined, sort of like there was a much smaller and much less publicly interested room on where open source software was defined, which was much more of a niche thing at the time compared to what AI is now. Everyone and their grandma knows what AI is or has an opinion on AI, and that'll make the definition of coming to an agreement much harder. That's kind of the point with openness. But I think the Claude 3 stuff is kind of more of our bread and butter. I think essentially vibes on the internet are that Claude 3 is better than GPT-4. I have to go on the record of haven't actually played around with it. I'm busy, but I don't think that
what corroborates those vibes? It's really just like threads.
It's long, many Twitter threads of people that I have exchanged ideas with for a while doing their challenge prompts and trying their best to break Claude 3
prompts. Yeah.
And doing side by side with Claude 3 and GPT-4 and Gemini. And all of these to try to get the sense of it. I think there's obviously things that people are impressed by Claude 3 on relative to GPT-4. The thing is, GPT-4 was trained in 2022. It's a long time ago. The original GPT-4, they keep updating it. GPT-4 Turbo was not trained in 2022. So I think that argument's a little dumb. I just got by somebody else's kind of stupid argument. This is the stuff that happens. But the clear thing is that it's at least as good as where GPT-4 Turbo is today. Like, it's comparable. So that has a lot of interesting arguments on if we're in an arms race, if large language models are going to be commoditized and all the like. I think we're kind of in it now. Like, the spring is always busy with AI. Like, last year we got GPT-4 and Llama 2 and all this stuff. Like, the spring is when people are trying to put in the work.
Yeah.
And then the summer's going to come and everyone's going to go on vacation again. We're not going to get any as big of bottles. Although, wasn't Llama 2 in July? I don't remember. When was Llama 2? I think so. But
I
like
wanted to
late
say it was
summer.
A bit later.
Late yeah. summer, like August, September, things will be slow. But we're in it. We're in the fucking pressure cooker. Like, every week it's like you can't sleep in. There's just crazy stuff. Like, Anthropic launched Claude 3 at like fucking 5 a.m. Pacific time. Like, the psychos, like, didn't even give us time to get a coffee before this is out. But it's really good, and I'm happy for them, even though I think their philosophical stance is in a deeply challenged spot now. That they're like, they just progressed the arms race, which is the really founding worry.
I mean, I'm not expert in this, but I guess I have training as a historian. And so there's a part of my brain that always is like going back to historical parallels of moments like this. When you think about like what is an arms race? Historically, I think the arms matter a lot less than the race. And what I mean by that is that often the benchmarks, if you want to call them that, across time are a little bit arbitrary. They're kind of some combination of shelling point on which there's some consensus of like, oh, that's impressive. And then on the other side, some kind of perceived impending fear of like conflict, which it's interesting. We're not really, we talk about these companies like they're competitors, but really neither of them is having much trouble raising money.
Well, most of the money that's raised is from, it's interesting because of the merger, M&A market is so bad for tech companies. Most of the big tech companies are investing in all of these kind of as a hedge that they won't be able to do M&A on it.
Of course.
So in the past, most of this investment was from VCs. So it's a really different dynamic. Mm-hmm. I think Elad Gil, who's a prominent investor, was writing about this in one of his like thought pieces on AI, which I was like, that's cool. I know nothing about investing, but it matters.
Everybody's in bed with everybody. It's kind of like, it's kind of incestuous, really, when you think about it. You take a step back. These are mostly the same, not just the same companies, but even the same people, you know, which, yeah, we don't need to get into the whole Musk thing. But I think that's...
It's just obvious what that is. It's the same thing.
It's an example, though, of this kind of... No, but where I was going with the historical stuff, the example that came to mind as you were speaking was in the aughts, not 2000s, but 1900s, there was this arms race called, like, the kind of dreadnought arms race. So I believe the British Navy came out with... I just said came out with, which is funny. They didn't like to release these things like models, but they deployed
Queen Elizabeth IV announces the second dreadnought class, our latest dreadnought class. Just
she's got her demo day. No, they deployed a ship called the HMS Dreadnought, which, and again, I'm neither an expert on, you know, battleships per se, but from I remember from a previous life, I was reading about this for some reason. It was a combination of things in terms of what made that ship like impressive. So it had a larger armament. I believe it had more guns. I believe the guns had a wider kind of degree of basically what they could shoot at. There's a more technical term, but there was a larger degree of freedom in terms of where you could point them. They were more accurate. They could shoot farther. They were larger, you know. This is where the famous like numbers around like, oh, it's like 12 inch guns or 16 inch guns, like I think this is sort of when that shit is starting. The ship itself, I believe, had a more sophisticated either profile or a much more robust engine, and so it was able to be deployed for longer periods of time, go out farther from port. So basically there was no one thing that made this ship that much better, but the combination of features basically made other navies around the world take notice and tell themselves like, oh shit, we need to get moving on this. Partly, I think, because there was nothing about the ship that couldn't be mimicked. You could sort of immediately see what the British Navy had done to achieve this. And so there was this kind of very, very quick turnaround where the United States, France, basically any other country that considered itself a naval power or wanted to be considered a naval power was immediately, you know, releasing their versions of like what was then called like post-dreadnought battleships. So the immediate, it was almost like an overnight thing. You either had a pre-dreadnought fleet or a post-dreadnought fleet in terms of what these things could
do.
Are
we in the post-GPT-4 fleet?
Well, that's interesting. I think the real shift was just... I've been consistent on this and thinking that I think the real shift was ChatGPT, right? So it's not even about the model so much as it is the model paired with the interface that is what really put everybody on notice, right? It put Google on notice, it put Anthropic on notice, a lot of companies on notice of like, we need to be competing on this just so that we're seen as important and part of the conversation. But then I think there's some interesting things about that history, right? One, with these battleships, to my knowledge, and if there are like naval historians of the early 20th century who listen to our episodes, I encourage you to reach out and tell me if I'm wrong about this. But my understanding is that in actual fact, none of the dreadnought class battleships in any major navy actually saw warfare. In other words, an enormous amount of capital was poured, resources, any number of things, material, into the creation, the renovation, and the release of these new types of ships, which were perceived to change the state of warfare. And then there was this major irony that even during World War I, none of that particular class of ship was actually like saw action. And that's, so there's that side of it. And then the second part, which is actually even kind of more surprising.
I think these language models are seeing action.
Well, I think we'll get to that. We have to think about what action means here. I mean, people were steering the ships. They were leaving port. I mean, there were these famous like grand tours that these ships would go on. Like even like Brazil had like a dreadnought ship. And they were like, look at our dreadnought ship. And it like went, and like, you know, went all around the world. People looked at it, took photos, and, you know, people wrote about it. They were like, oh shit, Brazil matters now. So there's one side of it that it wasn't really clear exactly what these ships were doing to change the state of play. And then the second thing is that arguably these ships really were, in hindsight, when you zoom out, really showing that battleships ended up not really mattering at all anymore, that they were really just a feature of navies that were meant to make certain things navies could do to be difficult for other navies to stop.
I don't know where I'm taking this.
Well, where I'm taking this is what really ended up mattering was aircraft carriers.
Yeah, but what's the analogy? I know that aircraft carriers are the things that matter.
Right, because that's actually what changed the nature of warfare, was the fact that we, and you couldn't do it immediately, but like soon, there was this ability for ships to really just function as floating cities where you could, you know, deploy planes. You could deploy anything, right? So the specific dynamics of naval warfare became less important than just mastering the ability to just deploy non-trivial parts of your armed forces anywhere in the world. And that's still the world we live in. Like, it's actually kind of remarkable the degree to which naval warfare, I mean, it really has not changed since World War II.
I would argue that drones and cheap drones are going to potentially change that as asymmetric warfare.
So,
the cost of engaging a aircraft carrier can become too high.
So that's the point, is that the dreadnought ships felt transformative, but they actually were not asymmetric. Because what did Germany do when Germany realized, like, oh, we can't compete with this? They were like, let's just make underwater boats. Like, nobody's really playing that market. That's what they call them, undersea boots. You know, U-boats, for short. That's all submarines are. They're just a way of cheating, in other words. Now there's these rumors that we're going to have, like, space warfare happening, and so that's, like, the kind of 21st century equivalent. So, yeah. I think for me, it's
tied to this all together.
Well, I think it's not. I think it's an open question for me whether what we're seeing right now, like with this arms race over language models, because frankly, like it's still just deep learning, as far as I'm concerned. There's an enormous degree of computation and data behind these things. Not very many. I mean, some other issues like RLHF notwithstanding. This is really just about scale and what scale makes possible. Scaling laws, like that still seems to be the world that we're living in here. I'm kind of skeptical that what we're seeing is really an asymmetric mode of competitiveness or capability. Like even now, I don't really think anyone has really mastered the art of monetizing these capabilities. People are using this stuff. But really, what is the business model here? No one really knows, which is why Google is scared shitless about its business model, which is search and hyperlinks.
I don't know. I feel like this is kind of missing the point of the arms race. I think there's more emotional energy in it than just the business model. It's like, I do think that the business model will follow. I don't necessarily, like, it's going to be like many past situations where there's a power grab and many of the companies fold, but the business models will be found and a few of them will latch onto it. But it's more of the energy that these people who are so worried about AI risk that they splintered their own company to be worried about the pace of progress are literally at the forefront of this pace increase. So it's like this pace is a thing that even people that are closely following the field experience. So those that do not follow the field and have this kind of progress fatigue because all they hear is about all the progress, and they're not part of it. So they get more of a fatigue than excitement, probably, because it's like when freaking all the news cycles are about Trump. It's like we stop feeling how bad he is, because it's like the next thing it's just normal. So people on the outside, I think, are almost potentially made easier by AI progress, but internally there is this sort of awe with how fast
things are going. I'm not quite sure what the parallel is there. I think we're just arguing different points.
I'm mostly arguing that I think the point that you're making is kind of irrelevant to the fact that Claude 3 is important. you're kind of saying the whole, you're trying to take the Gary Marcus angle, which makes me angry, which is like all of this doesn't matter because we're not going to make any money on it and it's all going to implode. And I'm kind of trying to argue the point that this matters at a like an emotional level, and how if there is such a rate of progress, it's pretty likely that it's going to continue on some level. When the pace is really high, it's rare that the pace goes from high to zero overnight. It's like the early versions of the iPhone or whatever. The delta between the versions is so big. While it's like nowadays, the different iPhones are really marginal. We're just still at the early days where there's so much room to make the technology better that I see that as very meaningful.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, I think my stance is actually much simpler than whatever Gary Marcus may or may not be arguing, which is that I think that the passion over Claude 3 is mostly vibes, and that its improvement or lack of it relative to GPT-4, I mean, it's like,
well,
these companies
are
kind of... Well,
if you look at the improvement to Claude 2, it's pretty large. Claude
sure.
2 is generally accepted as being bad.
I think this is maybe connecting to the open source conversation, which is like, what is the community that these models are actually catering to? Where is their actual hype and enthusiasm around this stuff? Well, there's a lot of hype, I guess, but where is their actual palpable enthusiasm over what you can do with these things? Clearly, people are feeling this. But
in engineering, like, I use this stuff every day on a technical level. So if something is better than ChatGPT, and I'll switch to that and become more productive.
So my question is, how wide does that horizon go, right? Like, what is the audience for these things? There is an audience, but is the audience actually as wide as we think it is, or is there acting like it is? I think the answer, at least so far, is unequivocally no.
I think that in years to decades, it's going to be that almost all information that we consume is mediated in some way by these technologies, whether it was generated by these technologies or it's filtered by these technologies.
So but that's an independent access, isn't it? Right. So that's absolutely true. I don't think either of us would disagree with that. I mean, we're clearly on the road to almost all information that is being generated or consumed as being mediated.
But the reason why it'll all be that way is because it offers value. So like regenerating things in the way that you want it is valuable. Transforming things to the modality that you want it is valuable. So like I don't have as much time to read as I can listen. So it's like I can translate everything into audio and listen to it via these models. And like those are all things that I either pay for already or will be paying for. And I think they'll just got to be wrapped into other tech products.
So I still think the question stands, like who does this add value to? Because if the answer is everyone, I would contest that, right? Like television replaced a lot of media in the mid 20th century to the point where basically, if you lived like in this country, you were sort of expected. I mean, the cultural zeitgeist was transplanted on a television. Television did create value, it added value, it transformed markets. It was huge. Most people, though, they consumed it passively.
But
they
it's
were
also
not
like
content
most of
creators.
The economy is not driven by, like, it's driven, they're individual users, but most of the economy is like a few companies that capture a lot of things. So it's like Microsoft rolls this out into every product that is used by all these Fortune 500 companies to make them more productive. Like, it's not technically everyone, but it could be effectively everyone. It could be effectively most of the economy.
Well, it's infrastructure, right? I mean, that's what that means.
I don't know how.
So the question then would be, I think we maybe are talking past each other here, because my point is really more like, I think that the value that these new capabilities are unlocking remains largely indeterminate and very liable to be monopolized or siphoned off by a relatively small circle of actors. So I guess as far as I'm concerned, my passion or my enthusiasm for open source, which is significant, comes from the fact that I would like the open source movement, or I would like however open source ends up getting rebranded or redefined, to interface with that dynamic. That's my only point here. So I'm not making any kind of prediction about the fact that this is snake oil, or even like claim that it's snake oil. I don't think it's snake oil.
What do you mean by interface? Like, to have an independent...
Well, I think I want open source to be more political. I want open source to be less about a vibes-based community of hobbyists who like playing with models, and more about a structural intervention on how it is that the value that these models are unlocking is able to be accessed and leveraged by larger groups of people across the supply chain. Because I think right now it's really very small, specific parts of the supply chain that where the value is like actually being like, it's like oil, it's like spurting out of the ground. And it's like, yeah, sure, you can put rigs on top of those spurts, but then it's not interesting to me that a small number of companies is able to do that right now. I would like that to change. And if I can't envision that changing, until I can envision that changing, I'm more likely to keep discounting whenever a new model comes out. Because then I'm like, sure, this matters in the sense that it's going to make some people way the fuck richer than they already are. But it's not. To me, that's incommensurate with what I would like open source to become.
I mean, there's fundamental questions on whether or not the capital requirements allow an open, because like the allow doing this in the open to even work, because you know, like how valuable the assets are, or if just one model gets leaked and then it's kind of then becomes open.
Well, but I think now you're naming it though, right? Because that's the point. If this industry is so capital intensive and the value is so stratified, is value being created or is value just really being transferred and monopolized in new ways? I think it's some combination of the two, but if open source can't meaningfully have any kind of lever on that process, what is it? Like, we shouldn't have a feedback loop where it's so capital intensive that only a few companies can even compete to access it, and then they're the ones who are creating value. You're not creating value if you're monopolizing a value implicit in that structure. Right. You need to show me. You need to show the public. You need to show users.
You can still create value in concentration of power, but that has all the issues with concentration of power. And I don't think that it's... Trends indicate that it's not going to be a monopoly. Like, for the next few years, it's going to be at least a triopoly of Google, Anthropic, and OpenAI. So, like, there's definitely not... Like, the monopoly word definitely did not apply for now. I do think it's still an immense concentration of power. Those are just two different things.
I mean, OPEC isn't technically a monopoly, but there aren't very many countries in OPEC. Right, and I guess that's... OPEC creates value. OPEC, literally, they release a lot of oil. But the prices that they set on that oil are famously arbitrary and really just reflective of what is...
Yeah, the arbitrary very price specific. Point right now is $20 a month for every AI service.
Yeah. Well, no. I guess
to Claude, Gemini, ChatGPT, Perplexity.
Part of the humor,
whatever.
Right. Part of the humor is like, right, because it wasn't even that long ago. We both remember when, you know, OpenAI started charging for monthly subscriptions to Turbo or whatever it was initially called, and it was a joke, right? Of like, yeah, how much? What number do you set on having this like pseudo AGI multimodal thing? Be your receptionist, or be your in-house worker, and like we don't know. Like even in a much better defined market, like streaming, where you know there's at least a long, decades long legacy of, again, television and like legacy forms of media that those things inherit. They're really just kind of digitizing them and providing that service at scale. even in that case, there's an enormous turnover and uncertainty around subscription costs. I mean, fuck, every other month I get some update from Netflix or Hulu of like, oh yeah, we're updating our subscription tiers. Because there's so many variables at stake. There's the variables of like, how do you scale? How do you retain users? How do you do that in a way that is also competitive against the other companies? Disney is all up in arms now because they're trying to consolidate what they accidentally made a very distributed media environment, because they have like three different platforms. They've got Disney Plus, they've got Hulu, and they've got ESPN. And like, they're realizing, it seems, that works right up until Netflix just keeps outpacing the ability for those platforms to like retain users. And so really what they have to do is agglomerate them into some single service, which it seems like that's what they intend to do now. But like, that's even in a much better defined, like there are so many shows already there. There are so many consumer expectations around what they're getting for a service like that. And I think I agree with you that that's still remarkably not true for AI, because Gen AI is still so new. The market really has not been locked in yet in terms of services. In terms of companies, I think it has been locked in, unfortunately.
I think it's interesting how different of framings we have come from this, because I came with like, oh, it's exciting, and you're like, oh, this is the same. I think the question is really around commoditization. Like, do you think that there's now three companies with similarly class models that it means that it's some more likely that somebody that's open favoring can do the same? Resources aside, if you could still have a rich billionaire or a government provide the same amount of resources that Anthropic or OpenAI has spent on one iteration of a model. It's like, what is the U.S. government's budget? It's like $600 billion or something. Or no, like $6 trillion. Because the number I have is like the Ukraine aid was requested at $60 billion, which was 1% of the federal budget. Mm. So it's like, for 0.1% of the federal budget, you could definitely recreate these technologies in the next few years. So if they are that important that they need to be opened, like the amount of capital involved is doable. I think the government doesn't really have the incentives to make it open yet. It's a hard thing. Like, the narrative and examples around openness are just beginning to emerge. There's this paper from Stanford on the social impacts of open foundation models. Yeah. And really the interesting part is like on the marginal risks of open models, where they debunk a lot of arguments against open models. And this is like the first brick, I think it's by this lead author is Sayash Kapoor at Princeton, who's doing great work. He's very smart, talked to him a few times. And the next step is like on the marginal benefits of openness. And it just takes this narrative thing. But the problem with openness is that it's so multi-stakeholder that agreement on narrative is nearly impossible to get. So like, even if it could be commoditized, it could be done in the open. Like, I don't know if there's ever going to be the same level of coordination to do it at the same scale that these essentially aggregators want to do.
I share that skepticism, honestly, just from what I know about the dynamics here. Well, to your point about why couldn't a government hypothetically do this, I do think incentives are one reason for that. I also think, this is a hunch, I think that human capital and human resources matter a lot more in AI than most people seem to think that they do. I think it was significant in terms of the dynamics of what happened at OpenAI in November, that what seems to really put pressure on that to play out the way that it did was the open letter that was like progressively signed by more and more people in like real time.
The one sentence, the AICP one, was existential risk is a problem that should be considered around climate change and
not that one. I mean the letter amongst the employees saying that if Altman is forced to leave, we'll leave.
Oh, okay, sorry, I was just totally missed something.
Yeah, those were different. Those were both 2023 was a busy year.
God, the open letters. I recently signed one because it was new. But open letters are not a means for political change in my mind. Maybe I'm just naive. Maybe the open letters are something that get policymaker attention because they're so general and I'm in the weeds as a technical researcher. This might be one of the flaws of being a technical person trying to do policy, is that you find open letters dumb by almost definition. But like, I do think maybe they matter more than I'm giving credit for, because they keep coming up, and the people that are proposing them are not like dumb. They're not trying to waste their time on these things. Like,
they clearly matter. I mean, it's not like just making any open letter has a difference, but yeah, it matters. I mean, I'm still seeing this. I think that we're...
There was one lot yesterday on evaluation and red teaming, which I signed. And I was okay, I guess it's like one of those things where it's hard to get the right people in the room, but you can get the right people on an open letter, and therefore it's like a pretty representative of a certain idea.
I mean, my concern with it, and yes, I've also signed open letters. So like, it's a tool, it's a mechanism, it's an instrument for change, but it's not itself, like, you can't supplant governance with open letters, because that's really just a kind of like public or like open technocracy. Like, you can't just have an oligarchy that's just open about who decides things and call that politics. I mean, you can, it's just, that's your oligopoly. That you're not any other kind of government, right? So it's not really, it keeps deferring questions of accountability and authority. And so if that's the dynamic we've settled into, that's unfortunate, because eventually it means that it will need to be changed with something more substantive, where it's not just like a bunch of smart people happen to agree with this one sentence description. Like, I, for example, I signed the one sentence letter that you mentioned saying, yeah, existential risk, yada, yada. And then the analogy at the end was like, AI has this risk profile comparable to, I think it was something like a pandemic.
Yeah.
Or something.
Pandemics and climate change.
Climate change. Okay. And I remember being on the fence, actually. I was invited to sign it, and I decided that I was going to sign it. And then the very next thing I did was publicly post that I did sign it, but that I also felt that there was a much larger and richer class of analogies that were needed to even make it clear what that risk profile was. And then I just named what those things were. That was my way of threading that needle in that case. I had friends who chose not to sign it because they were so offended at the limitations behind the analogy in that one sentence that they didn't. And I didn't disagree with them. I was like, right, so we're both navigating the same tension here. But the point is, I think my point, here's the point I'm trying to make. I don't want that to be the axis along which politics around AI works. For the last year or so, that does seem to be a major axis along which politics around AI has worked. But it's ironic to me that open letters have this kind of cachet at the same time that it's also just become accepted that like Chatham House rules are dictating like when and how most of these in-person high-level bougie events like happen.
Because Chatham House rules is kind of hilarious, because it's almost like such a loophole that it doesn't matter, because like, you can say anything without attribution, but most of the things that anyone is going to reproduce normally can be narrowed down to like 1 to 3 people, even if you don't attribute it. So it's really like, there's still substantial trust mechanisms.
Yeah. We don't know in AI what accountability means. I think that's the common denominator. And that's maybe relevant. That's maybe relevant for open source to the extent that, yet again, we're kind of circling this ambiguity about the relationship between transparency and accountability. You can have open letters, you can have academic or civil convenings where issues at a high level are named and stakes are assigned to them. But that's not politics.
Yeah, I have a proposal for another way the AI conversation emerges, which is through pop culture. We went through the whole Oppenheimer review right when we were starting this. And now Dune is also like, I guess the Dune movie doesn't have as much of a commentary on technology as the book series does. But like, that's an important theme of Dune, is the like implications of technology.
Yeah,
and concentration of power.
Yeah, stuff. Let's take it to Dune. So yeah, we didn't have an episode last week because Nate and I were actually in person, and we got up early and we saw a showing of the new Dune movie Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. I believe, on the Upper West Side.
and we were
kind of processing that. And so we were like, yeah, we're still in the midst of that. But yeah, so Dune, the universe of Dune is a good example. where, for those who don't know, the whole kind of really the arch premise of Dune is that there is no AI. There are no robots. There is no data-driven optimization at scale. The Dune universe, it's funny, it's actually impressive the degree to which there is no, I can say more about this, but like there is no scaling. There is like everything is feudalistic. You're either above somebody or below somebody. And there's like, it's all monopolies. There's all, and these monopolies have monopolized different kinds of power. So there's the navigation monopoly. There's the kind of, for lack of a better word, psychic monopoly, which is what Bene Gesserit have. There's the kind of political monopoly, which is, that's the literal kind of feudal structure of like the emperor and the different houses underneath him. So these lanes are very, very rigidly defined. And there is no AI, because the whole point of Dune is that previous to these events of the movies and the books, there was this event called the Butlerian Jihad, which is where there were self-aware machines who rose up in opposition to, I mean, eventually all of humanity. There was this prolonged war between those two groups. Interestingly, humanity prevailed. This seems to be something we've lost hope in now, but in the Dune universe, humanity wins. And the result of that is, I think it's strongly implied, these incredibly ossified lanes of power that cannot be changed. That's sort of the cost.
The amount of like memes you can make about OpenAI in this movie and what we're talking about is so high. I would like to take my one meme as the... There's an awesome sequence on Gaiety Prime, which is the Harkonnen home planet, and I am now forever imagining a OpenAI all hands as being like that sequence. So now if you see it, you'll know. But there are many, many more memes around concentration of power and AI within it.
But still, the drama of the story is that these concentrations of power are incommensurate with each other. So if you see the new movie, I think actually does a great job of this. You see how power is distributed in qualitatively different ways across these factions, across these different sectors, right? So the Gaiety Prime sequence you mentioned, I guess I don't want to spoil it exactly, but like it, you see a very specific, this character, Fade Rotha, who's like, I mean, psychotic. And he's great at fighting, and he's great. He's like, he's at the pinnacle of his craft in a certain sphere. And then you see him interact with basically the representative of the psychic monopoly, which is the Bene Gesserit. And he's basically laid low, you could say, by the kind of power they represent. Now, so everyone is sort of circling each other. Everybody has, it's like a game of rock, paper, scissors, but with like all of humanity and all of civilization. And the central drama of the story is when you have a character who, by luck, happenstance, or whatever, is able to embody all those different sources of power at once in a way that cannot be controlled and cannot be, that old game can't control that entity anymore, then what happens? And the movie is great, actually, because actually what it shows is what happens is tragedy. It's a very dark movie. It ends up being a very kind of bleak, moving, but bleak story about the fact that, ironically, the main character, Paul, is the most constrained of any character in that movie, because his path is, he has prescience, but what that shows him is that everything is basically predetermined, and the best he can do is something that's actually deeply self-destructive or violent in some ways. But it is a great movie, and we enjoyed, I mean, seeing it together, I was kind of blown away by it. It's an overwhelming experience. Yeah. I was going to tell the story briefly of like, you know, Dune occupies a specific place in like the psyche of AI, because again, there is no AI in it. It was one of the first major science fiction sagas, like franchises, whose central premise was that there is no AI, that there's no prospect of that. This is totally different than Arthur C. Clarke or, you know, Robert Heinlein. Like, there's not even the prospect of it. The whole universe's logic depends on the impossibility of that event. And I've had interesting conversations with Stuart Russell. I've brought him up before on the podcast about, I think Stuart Russell had a formative experience with those novels when he was young, because we were just chatting once, and he, I think accidentally let slip that he's memorized the like first 10 mantras of the Orange Catholic Bible, which is the like syncretic religion that defines the entire Dune mythos. And like the first of those is like, thou shalt not make a machine in the image of the human mind or something like that. But then there's deeper cuts on how it works. And Stuart had committed that to memory. So yeah, it's, you know, it's still true that the limits of human nature, that's why people love science fiction, is that it expresses the limits of human nature. There's something about pushing technology to its limit that pushes us to our limits. And you see our different predispositions come out in those settings. And the movie does a great job of, yeah, dramatizing that. The fact that there's a fundamentalist religion as like the central kind of motive force of the story is very interesting too. Because I think if we're being honest, like we often treat AI as a religion much more than we do anything else. You know, you either believe in it fundamentally or you don't believe in it fundamentally. And there's an enormous kind of pressure now to say like, what is the priesthood that gets to define how the public, what are the stories the public is going to have to play with around this technology? And that's the current lay of the landscape. And, you know, I think that ideally there would be a way for that priesthood to open things up a little bit to the laity in terms of how those stories get told or reproduced or played with, where we try something else. But that's actually the state of things right now.
That makes sense. I have a giveaway. I have a few hats that say Stochastic Parrot on them from a podcast friend, Late in Space. I ended up with too many of them. I'm going to send one to the author of the paper. But if you're still listening, you can get in touch and I'll mail you one of these hats if you want them. They're kind of like the GPU poor hats. They're very minimalistic and you can watch.
How many do you have?
I have 4, 2 of which are already accounted for.
And it just says, yeah, you showed it briefly.
It says Stochastic Parrot.
It just says, that's all it says. There's no parrot on it.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So that's what we got. Loyal listeners, I'll pay postage. Hopefully not international, but figure it out. I need to reflect more on how different of the Claude takes that we have had, but it is good grounding. In my future, probably not in the next couple of weeks, I want us to do more of a side-by-side comparison of all of these and just get a sense for what language models actually can and cannot do. I think that's a worthwhile exercise, just playing with language models and seeing what you get. Maybe I'll record it. It'd be kind of entertaining for people. Just the process of doing this is very important to get a grounding on where we are at.
Mm-hmm.
But that's mostly what I've got. I think it's an interesting debate.
Yeah. We'll keep the energy going.
Sounds good.
Okay. Everybody have a good week.
Right,
we'll see
now.
You. Bye.